on the 30th of September, the very last day. So, hi. What would you like to go over? Yes. How much should you know about the adaptations at birth? Well, first you should know that there are necessary adaptations, and you should have a sense of what they are, which organ systems are involved particularly, but you don't need to know the details of kidney function, for example. But you should know that the kidneys have to start doing something. You don't need to know the phrase foramen ovale for what happens in the heart, but you should know that that opening between the two chambers has to close off to redirect the flow of oxygenated blood. So just know that they do happen and be able to recognize what they are. It also would be useful to recognize the reason for those adaptations, and all of those are because the placenta is disconnected. So you're taking over for yourself as an infant all of the functions that the placenta has done for you before. So it's that extra uterine life that's driving this.
From the book, how much do we have to know about, statistics and numbers? Do we have to know that stuff?
Yeah, the question is, I'm repeating the question for the web. I know you can all hear, but the statistics and numbers in the text are not terribly important to me. I wouldn't ask you a question, for example, which of the following percentages is the number of African Americans who suffer from, is it 20%, 15%, 10%, or 5%? I would never, ever ask a question like that. Julie would never let me ask a question like that, because it's the kind of trivia and detail that you don't need to fill your head with. So those sorts of things you don't need to know. It might be useful, since I used the example of African Americans suffering from some kind of disease, it might be helpful to know that African Americans are at greater risk of many things in our culture, and that of course is tied to racism and poverty. Not exclusively, but racism and poverty are part of access to health care, income, where people have been forced to live, the kind of work they've had to do, those sorts of things. So it would be useful to know that, in general, that privileged white people have fewer problems than poor anybody. But specific numbers, I don't know them, so I don't expect you to know them. Yes. The phases of the prenatal period, there are three major phases, and the text describes each of these, labels them. So the germinal phase is the period between conception and implantation. I think that's the way they define germinal. But essentially it means that you're at the beginning, so the germ of an idea or the germ of a person you started. And then as differentiation begins in earnest and the embryo itself begins to form, then you enter a period called the embryonic period, because the embryo is forming and all the various organ systems are beginning. And then once all of those systems have started, then, and that's toward the end of the first trimester, eight to 10 weeks, depending on how you measure it, then from then on, it's a period of the fetus. So it's called the fetal period. And that's a period that's characterized largely by growth and elaboration of those systems that have already started. So it's the germinal, the embryologic, and the fetal periods. The question is, what do I mean, explain the process of motor coordination, the development of motor coordination. And I'll do something that you'll hear me do often. Your question was whether I meant the head to toe or near to distant principles in that, or whether I meant the sequence. And I'll turn your or to an and. So it would be helpful in thinking about that kind of study question to think about explanations that describe the sequence developmentally and the principles that sequence follows. There are different parts of the answer. And what's the phrase for the head to toe? Cephalocaudal. Yeah. And near to far? Proximal distal. The text defines both of those as directions or major principles of motor development. It's also, they're also principles of structural development prenatally. But in motor development, what it means is that the cephalocaudal refers from head to toe, or tail, actually. Caudal is tail. Which means that the development is fastest and earliest at the head, and the head is predominant in growth early on, and then it moves toward the lower extremities. So, and it's the brain that's most important, obviously, in the long run. Proxima distal, proximal meaning near or close by, and distal meaning far. The proximal distal principle is that development at the center is earliest and most important, and then it extends out toward the extremities. So it's both head down and from the midline or the center out. So you work on the gut and the torso first, and then that gives you something to hang arm buds and leg buds on. And then you can't have toes out there developing until you have feet to put them on. You can't have feet till you have legs. So you're sort of naturally developing them in that order. It would be fun to think about developing in a different direction. It's just that we don't. So for example, you could start with toes and then grow ankles and calves and knees and thighs and hips and then work up to a head. But that's just not the way it works. And in the sequence, it would be useful to have a general idea. I wouldn't ask you what age a child rolls over from front to back or back to front, which comes first. I don't know, so I wouldn't ask you. But it would be useful to know that a kid is think, and all you have to do is think about it, where an infant starts. It's lying down. And at some point, it's going to have to figure out how to roll over. And as it does that, it's going to be able to move itself from back to front, front to back. And it's probably going to do that before it learns to sit up. And somewhere along the line, it has to get its four limbs under it so it can rise up on hands and knees. And then after it gets up, it can learn to crawl, but it's not going to learn to crawl until it does that. And in each of those transitions, each skill that it's acquiring, you have an example, typically, if you think it through, of what it's doing. It's differentiating one part of the body from others, and then it's integrating those systems, those parts that it's learned to control, into a more complex motor action. So in order to turn over, you have to extend. Think about it for a minute. I didn't demonstrate this in class because my iPod fell out of my pocket, but if you're lying down on your back, you have to differentiate left from right and do different things with the left side and the right side, because if you do the same thing with both sides, then you have both arms stretched out and you're never going to turn over if you've got that. Or you've got both pulled in and you might get closer to turning over if you do that. But what you really have to do to turn over is get one arm out and the other end tucked under you, and then you push with the one that's extended and that rolls you over. But as long as you have the other arm extended at the same time, you can't go anywhere. So it's important that you figure out how to do different things with the two sides. And at the hip end, again, you have to stretch one leg out and flex the other. So you bend it at the knee and hip, so you pull it up. And that gives you the leverage. If you push with the foot that's cocked now under you, then you propel your lower side over. And that has, again, it requires differentiating the two sides, the left and right. So you're doing something different with them. And every action that the child learns to do involves that kind of differentiation and control, and then putting them together to effect the action, to make the action happen. And that happens in every part of physical development. Can the body ever stop benefiting from exercise? For all practical purposes, no. No. The text describes some research. I think what they cite was done at Tufts with people over 80 with strength training and resistance training and increasing aerobic capacity. And it was the first study that actually demonstrated that you can build muscle mass beyond 80. The assumption had always been that you lose the ability to increase muscle mass. Your muscles are atrophying, but that's not true. You can build aerobic capacity, and you can build muscle mass up till death, as far as anybody knows. So, and it's a good idea to do it. So we have a program, this is new and it wouldn't be on the exam, so I won't dwell on it, but one of the things that came out of the Tufts research was not just muscle mass and aerobic capacity, but bone density. weight-bearing exercise increases bone density at any age. So they developed at Tufts a program for old people called Build Strong Bones, BSB. And they train people to do resistance training programs with elders, and they've worked it out so that even if you're sitting in a chair, you can put stress on bones in healthy ways. And they have a whole series of exercises that you can lead people through to help them build bone and reduce the potential of breaking bones as they get thinner, as you get older. It's a nice addition. If you know Tai Chi, which is focused on balance and flexibility, Tai Chi doesn't have resistance as part of the routine, except for the legs, for your changing stance. But it has very little in the way of resistance for the arms, and almost none for the torso. So the Build Strong Bones is a nice complement to that. You might as well learn Tai Chi now if you haven't, and be prepared to do it the rest of your life, and then add resistance and aerobic training to it. And then you'll be congratulating each other when you're 95 that you're still very healthy. The focus questions and the study questions are different in that what I've tried to do, and I'll let you tell me if I'm successful, the focus questions are ones that I expect to answer in lecture. I think so far I've done that. There may be one that I didn't, but that's my intent, that the focus questions, by focusing on them at the beginning of the unit, and then revisiting them, which I didn't do very much in class, but I do for myself, those are ones that I would like to answer as we go through. The study questions are much more general, and I may not talk about most of those. They're to help you think further. Not that the focus questions won't, but the study questions will give you another way to look at the reading and to think about the material, and raise questions, some of which don't have answers. So the study questions are more random, and I'm likely never to lecture about them. The focus question, how do you know what to do when you're born, is partly about the adaptations. So that would be one part of that. Another part would be you would focus on the reflexes and the potentials of the structures that you're born with. So you engage in random activity, but that random activity really isn't random. It's based on what your body physically can do. So you'd move from the adaptations the body has to make, which are part of your genetic baggage, to the actions that you would do. There's that obnoxious noise again. So that would be a part of that, of the material that would apply to that focus question. And then you might also think about the sensory systems that the infant is born with, and think about the eyes and the ears and molding, you know, responsiveness to touch. Those also are built into the system, but trying to track objects, trying to focus your eyes, is necessary. It's an activity that will lead to the ability to accommodate. So part of, again, all of these are built in, and that's what you know. You only know how to do things that are built in. Or there's also the possibility, if you think about the exposure to rhythms of mother's voice, particularly in utero, if you think about responding to music in utero, when you're born, there may be a preference for particular kinds of music or rhythm. There may be an ability to more quickly identify the mother's voice compared to other voices because of its cadences, the way it's modulated, sort of the pitch, the tone, the rhythm. If you've heard those things in utero and the ears are working, you should have a familiar pattern so that when you hear that pattern again after you're born, you should be able to discriminate that from other voices that you hear, which may be why kids are so quickly able to identify their mothers, distinguish them from other people. Okay. What do you think? Can you grow taller than your genetic potential? No? Why not?
Because your genetic potential gives you a range of the height, the tallest you can be and the shortest you can be, and your environment affects where you are within that range.
Okay, within that range. Well, why couldn't you go beyond that range?
Because your genes say you can't.
Because you can't. Because if you can, that's part of your range. So it's a trick question, actually, and it occurs again in the next unit and the following unit. You can't do anything that isn't within your genetic potential. If you can do it, it's part of your potential. Vanessa? The observation is that your height may have more to do with diet than with your parents. It would be interesting to know how much was each. And that's one of the things that geneticists do, is try to figure out how much is each. But both are clearly involved. I think you could have fed me any amount of high-quality food that you had wanted, and I wouldn't have been over about 6'2 or 6'3. I assume. It's an article of faith on my part. And I certainly tried to feed my son well, and he didn't get any taller than I did, so. Biologists and psychologists love to argue about how much is which, and they do all kinds of statistical finagling with the notion of heritability. And it's an interesting question, but generally everything is multiply determined. Freud said that. Most of the important things in life have multiple causes. Well, in general, whether we covered something in class, if we covered it, it's likely to be on the exam or potentially on the exam. The fact we don't cover something doesn't eliminate it from consideration. So the question was specifically about old age, and we didn't talk much about that or about dying itself. So I wouldn't steer you away from reviewing that material and thinking about whether there are examples in it of things that we did talk about. But with 50 questions, 50 multiple choice, it's a little hard to cover everything. So we are selective. 50 multiple choice and 3 essays. You heard it here first, that in class I said, I believe on several occasions, that it'd be 4 out of 6 essays. Julie reminded me that it's really 3 out of 4. And I appreciated that. She stopped me before I got to making up more essay questions. Partly because the length of the exam, both in writing it and reading it, gets out of hand. So there'll be 3 out of 4. And I'll put that in the email that you'll all get within the next few hours, maybe. Question: how long are we expecting the essay responses to be? 2 sentences is too little. Paragraph and a half. Yeah. I was trying to figure out how I would know that it was half a paragraph instead of a whole paragraph. A couple of brief paragraphs or one reasonably long paragraph would be desirable. What you'll have is half a page of space, half a regular size sheet. So that gives you half a legal sheet? We've done both. So you'll have half a sheet of paper of some size. And Julie will figure out which it is. It may be as long as half a legal size. But anyway, what we do is 1 sheet, 2 questions on each side. You get half the sheet for each, whichever size we choose. But the more helpful response is that the questions are all complex enough that they incorporate more than 1 or 2 simple ideas. So it's, if you find that you think you've answered it in a sentence or two, if those aren't complex sentences, it might be useful to think through again what else you might say. In general, particularly on the first exam, the biggest difficulty is answers that are so brief that we can't be sure whether the student knows what he or she is trying to say. We don't assume anything. So we don't read into the answers what we know. So what we're looking for is what you know. And that means giving it, maybe telling it to us again and giving an example would be desirable. And answers that are more elaborated and explained more fully are clearly going to get more points than ones that we're left not knowing whether you really understand it or not. I don't know why it does that.
It has the same sign on it as the rest of the doors, that if you use it, not between like 5 and 7 or whatever the hours are, the alarm will go off. But the alarm goes off all the time anyway, so if you go out that door.
So all I have to do is trip people before they get to that door?
Yeah.
Okay. Could we do something else, like just turn off the alarm in this room? Okay.
It's just coming down the hallway.
Oh. Okay. That's interesting, because it always sounds to me as if it's coming from equipment up there in the ceiling or something. That's probably just my own personal nightmare or something. So probably if I go close this door, I won't hear it as much. There's a hypothesis. I'll try anything. What are you afraid I'll ask that you won't know? They know no fear. Yes. There will definitely be questions about puberty, and you should know some generalities about the hormones. I wouldn't ask you to repeat, to replicate, or fill in the blanks on the chart that I gave you. That would be.
Do we have to know what the categories are?
I would know generally which ones are associated with. Characteristics that are considered masculine and which one are feminine. Know a little bit about where the hormones come from, but you don't have to know how to spell adrenocorticotropin or norepinephrine or any of those things. Androgens?
Yeah, estrogens, and then what's the last one?
Gestagens, which primarily is progesterone. It's those hormones that are related to gestation or pregnancy. Yes?
Would you make an essay that
Would I make up an essay that was strictly based on the text that we hadn't talked about in class? My inclination is to say no, but I want to be, I don't want to mislead you. So I'm thinking through essay questions, and then I'm going to look at Julie.
Probably not.
Okay. There's your assignment. Go back and look at all the exams from the last couple of years. And see if we have asked any essays that were not things that we had talked about in class. I think we have not. But I can think of one particular question that I have used, not last year, in various versions, where only a very small part of the answer would come from material in the lecture. And the rest was from the text. But it was the sort of question that you probably also could have done reasonably well on if you thought about everything that you've ever heard of that was healthy for people and everything that you'd ever heard of that wasn't healthy. So probably you could answer that question without reading the text and do reasonably well on it, which is probably why I didn't use it last year. Did I? The angel question? Okay. The particular question I'm thinking of is suppose you were the angel responsible for a person from conception through death. What would you want to make sure happened and didn't happen? Physical. You're responsible for the physical development and well-being of the individual. What would you want to make happen and not happen in that person's life? It's based on what my angel does for me. Right, Herb? Okay. Herb's okay. Herb's a friend who, you know, was very fond of me when he died, and I realized many years later, when I was young, he was family friend, and then he died, and I realized several years later that he was being my guardian angel. So everybody should have one. That won't be on the exam, even as a multiple choice question. What is the name of Larry's guardian angel? What?
Extra credit.
Extra credit, right. Now, we sometimes do give credit if you remember to put your name on your exam. And spell it right. I think, to elaborate on that answer a little bit, I think that the essay questions are more likely to be general enough that they have their origin in lecture material, but it's possible to use text material that we haven't talked about to elaborate or to illustrate. There will definitely be multiple choice questions that we haven't touched in class. That's the reward for reading the text. Better understanding and a few extra points on the exam. What else should we talk about, Julie?
I don't know.
Have you all reviewed the main points on the web? Okay, because my question was going to be, is that helpful to have if you've looked at it? It's on the course website, not on WebCT. And the address, the website is in the syllabus. And then if you look down through the list of things that you can access, there's a page for each unit and a page for main points, page for the reading guide for the text, page at the bottom is the recordings. So you just click on whichever one you want. And it opens up ideally most of the time. And definitely I would play around on that website to review the overheads and all of that if you haven't, and certainly the main points for this unit. The main points is about a page worth of material, and it's an outline of the whole unit. And many of the questions do draw from the overheads especially ones that I've talked about, and they are, for the most part, on the website. So reminding yourself, because I usually don't leave them up long enough that you can copy them all down, but that's why they're on the website, so you don't have to do that. Are any of you printing them out before class and using them to outline? Do you have an example of what you've printed? Because you know, each unit, I end up with.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of people in class with that.
Okay. Yeah, I guess it comes out on 7 or 8 pages for me, but I don't consider that excessive, but then I'm not paying my own printing costs. Yeah. Okay. I wonder if there's a way to reduce it when you print it. I don't know. They're in different tables or different cells.
Yeah, cells. They're in different cells, and that makes it hard to copy and paste like a whole thing, because then you get big spaces between the cells.
Oh, you get big spaces between the cells.
Which is why there's copy and paste.
Okay, I don't get big spaces between the cells. So it may be the program that you're using. Make a note. Let's see if we can find out what the variability is, because mine prints it straight as it is. What you see is what I get. And I don't get any big spaces.
I mean, just like normal text, the way that I have it is a lot more condensed than that is.
Yes. Okay. When you're ready to print, check me on this, Julie, and check to see if it works. When I'm ready to print, I reduce the size of the font that I'm looking at. So if I want to show something in class, for example, I choose a large typeface, a large font, so it'll show up on the screen. But when I print, I reduce the size of what's on the screen, and it prints the size that's on the screen. So I can probably reduce what you're printing by half when I print it. And I can do that because it's just simply printing the program as presented on the screen. If it were a PDF file, I couldn't do that. But because it's a straight web page, I can reduce the size of what I'm viewing, and it will print at that size. So you might want to try that. Go up to, depending on what program you use, probably View, and reduce the size of the font before you print. And you can reduce it way down. Right. Yeah, just printing straight off the web page. And then you probably can get a lot more on. But would you try it, Julie, and make sure that really works? It may be what I'm using for a program. And it may be different on different programs. Another way to do that, a second way, one is to reduce the font size. The other is on when you print, the window in most programs will give you the option when you're printing from a web page straight, it will give you an opportunity to scale. It will say scale, print scale. And if you look, sometimes that'll be, depending on whose computer you use, it may be 100%, it may be 125%. If you knock that down to 50%, it'll print it much smaller. So there are at least two ways. Try that one too, Julie, see if it makes sense. Because if it does, then I can put those instructions on the web. So people are more likely to print it out and have it. The problem I'm aware of, though, is trying to do it before class, is that I am very often in lecture talking from material that's not yet on the web. Because I'm, believe it or not, lecturing about new stuff I don't know yet. So it isn't on the web yet, until after lecture. So there is that problem with it, but it's still okay for reviewing.
If we go for that, will that make it harder to read, or would it just make it just big? I don't mean like on less pages, but would you be able to?
You might have to play around with it. The question is, if you reduce the scale or reduce the font, will it be too small to read? And that's possible. You'd want to adjust it for yourself. The other thing you can do with many programs is print double-sided and use less paper. You won't use less ink, but you'll use less paper. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ain't technology wonderful? We never had to talk about this years ago. Actually, we didn't have to talk about this before this year in this course. No, we had the website. We had the website 2 years ago. 2 years ago. Does that mean you've run out of content questions? Vanessa's falling asleep. Okay? Go study. Efficiently, and get a good night's sleep Monday night. Take a break during the day.